Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this meeting organised by North London Park Socialist Party. Normally the chairman would spend a few minutes boring you with details of what we stand for, but bearing in mind the title, and we're only here for an hour, I'll let Bill get straight into it.
Right, thank you, Chair. Given that we haven't got ravening hordes here, I'll try and keep it nice and sweet and short and simple, and then hopefully we can have a nice lively discussion afterwards. So, I'm just going to breach health and safety a little. And move that so it's on the table. Please beware of the wire, Julian. Right. Okay, well, as usual, I normally begin by stating why I think the topic is relevant and useful and why we should be bothering even to discuss it. And what I'll look at then is I'll give a very, very, very brief definition of socialism and try and put forward what could be considered to be a key, I think, case for socialism. Then maybe a little bit about what socialism isn't, and to try and contextualise what we're arguing for, and then to try and say why socialism, how the main method by which it resolves the faults of capitalism, and what socialism can positively offer, and then I'll end with just coming back over a couple of the points. And trying to sort of like redefine in the light of what I've said about socialism. So, I mean, the reason for the topic is that any of us who've spent any time on the platform, historically, would spend 80 to 90% of the time talking about why capitalism is rubbish, and I'm just saying capitalism is useless and win that argument over in the first instance. In the present situation where we've had 4 long years of economic austerity, economic crisis, with no end in sight and worse yet to come, it's become rather redundant to do that. I mean, it's obvious to, very obvious to everyone. I mean, there's still bitter end defenders of capitalism out there who just won't accept that. And there'll be other people who may kind of, you know, in practical terms, continue to accept capitalism. So what we need to look at for ourselves is how we put the bread and butter party case for socialism. And when I say the case, I mean realistically there's not one case. There's lots of different cases, different nuances of the case. I'm going to put a particular case, and one that I think is nice and simplistic, and cuts to the chase. But as William Morris said at the start of News from Nowhere, there were 5 socialists in the room and therefore 5 different ideas about the moral of the revolution. And this talk kind of has its companion, how I became a socialist, which is obviously the one where everyone has their own individual take on socialism, whereas I'm going to try and cut through all the various versions to present a coherent and concise argument, and one that you can put forward quickly, because I think also as part of having this talk is to, and for party members who are here, otherwise it's a waste of their time, enable them to go out and win the argument. So, very quickly, the very most basic definition of socialism, one of the best I've seen, Karl Marx, he was asked by a New York Times journalist, what is the aim of the socialist movement, the communist movement, and Karl Marx simply said, the emancipation of labour. So that's our first working definition of socialism. It might not, it's very woolly in its stead. Obviously, Marx was being of his time, and this was shortly around about the same time as the emancipation of the slaves. So emancipation was clearly a well understood concept, and the emancipation of labour was clearly linking the cause of the wage labourer and the working class with those of the recently emancipated slaves in the United States. And as such, I mean, so it's freeing us from wage slavery, freeing us from the conditions of being workers. But that's not even then a foolish definition. So I'm also going to add to it that we need to look at the means, how we are emancipated, what is the mechanism, what is the way in which we can sustain that emancipation. And to try and get round all the other lots of arguments about words, 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 I quite like the phrase, a community of goods. I'm going to come back to that later, but I think that that is what we're talking about in when we say socialism is a community of goods, which practically means two things at the same time. One is that goods are held in common, the goods of the world, and in another, that the community is defined by the goods that it holds and by this shared control of the means of production and distribution of wealth. So it's important to try and put forward a concise case. I mean, you'll find in any argument, the losing side wants to draw out more and more, throw out different points, throw out different arguments, be scattergood in their approach, and to say, what about this, what about this? If you listen to 9/11 truthers, you know, whenever you nail them on one particular point of their case, they'll go, ah, but what about the debris that shows there might be precursors or post-plastic explosives in the debris? And then you'll point out that there's this paper here that says that. Well, they say, yes, okay, maybe you've got that one, but what about the ninjas that were seen planting explosives in the base of the building? Or something like that. They can never be pinned down. So if you're winning an argument, as evolutionists do, they say, well, you know, we've got this very simple case. Here's the key point, and if you disprove this point, our case unravels. You hold on and focus like a laser on your strongest case and demand that the other side disproves it. The most basic justification for socialism is also the one that people use against us most often, and that is that someone has to do the dirty work. Or more prosaically, someone has to do the unskilled manual and clerical labour. And there's a technical term for the people who do this work in present-day society. They're called failures or losers. And this society can conceive of no way of getting people to do this work that we absolutely have to have done other than to force people to do it and then condemn them for doing it. And you can watch telly all day, you can be a news addict like I can be and listen to all the politicians rabbiting on, and they have nothing, absolutely nothing to offer these people. When you listen to them, Nick Clegg, David Cameron, Ed Miliband, they'll say, what we offer is skills and training and opportunity. What they're saying is that they're offering them the opportunity to stop being unskilled clerical and manual labour. Now, why this is so important, I think, is because we are part of a vast productive system in which each part is as important as any other part. And I hesitate for many and several reasons to use the clockwork metaphor, because it has been used in a horrible way. But the key point about the metaphor of clockwork is that the smallest cog, if that stops working, the entire machine grinds up. And our case would be that without unskilled office cleaners, and I say, well, actually, this term unskilled, anyone who's trying to do these jobs will find, well, actually, there's lots of skill. It's, you know, you can't just walk in and do it. It's just called unskilled as a matter of prejudice a lot of the time. You know, if you see anyone who's experienced and done them for a long period, you realise that there is a lot of skill involved, even in the most basic jobs. But the, you know, without office cleaners, Bill Gates would not be a billionaire. I mean, it is as simple and blunt as that. Without all the associated labour of the world working together, the millionaires, the billionaires, the masters of the universe, they would have nothing. Now, of course, the converse is true. Without Bill Gates, we would not have his computers. I mean, that is absolutely true, but he is just yet another person who is part of a vast, vast extended network of production. And this is the wonderful achievement of capitalism, if you will. The capitalism has brought together so many people to do this cooperative work. And you can see some of the basis of the germs of socialism in our capitalist workplaces. Because in the workplace, you don't charge your colleagues for your time. You don't turn out to them and say, well, I'm going to bill you for what I'm doing. You go and help your colleagues according to the structures that you have, and you know, to someone's line management and what have you. But you cooperate. I mean, that's how we exist in these workplaces. Now, of course, in some of the higher end city firms, they do bill each other for their times. But that's part of the trying to reimposition of ideology. The fact is that for the most part, most people get by in their working day by helping each other out, and in a non-commodity relationship. That's what capitalism has done. It has destroyed commodity relations between workers, which used to be that, you know, the craft worker would make his commodity and sell it on. It would be a he, I should add. But now they work together. And I think it's not an accident, just to mention as an aside, that whenever people want to come up with counterexamples or they want to question socialism, they will almost invariably say there's one of two things. They'll say, right, so suppose I made a chair in socialism. It's either a chair or a table. And the reason why they're always asking about chair, and it's true, I heard this hundreds of times in different internet forums, at Speaker's Corner, it's always a bloody chair. The world is full of chair makers. The reason why they choose that is because one person conceivably could make a chair without the help of anyone else. I mean, that's, you know, if we assume, I mean, really, if we're going to get very forceful about it, really, one person could nap their own flint, produce an axe, chop down some wood, and then use the flint to make the wood into shapes that could make a chair. They wouldn't have to even use any tools made by another person. But the bottom line is that even these so-called handicraftsmen will have used the labour of someone else, embodied in a chisel or a lathe or some machine produced somewhere else, or in fact someone else would have cut down the wood. So an example doesn't quite hold against us, but it's there. It's clearly a formidable part of ideology, this question of, suppose I made a chair. Well, in capitalism we don't make a chair, we do it together, but we do it in the interests of the employers, or of the owners, and that is the key flaw of capitalism. So we've got this wonderful achievement, it has unleashed cooperative labour, but at the same time it's holding it back and making sure that it has to be run. And I really, as I said, I wasn't going to spend my time knocking capitalism, but you can't know what socialism is without a little bit of contradistinction of now and again. So, bearing this in mind, I think it's important that we remain modest in our claims for socialism. It's very easy to get dragged away and, you know, say it's going to be a whole new world, we're going to create new people or whatever like that. And I think that's impossibly dangerous, the way of thinking. Socialism has to begin with human beings as they are now. And if you look at the street outside, you know, come the morrow of the revolution, that street will still be there. And our workplaces will still, I mean, hopefully it'll happen sometime in our lifetime, so we can say, you know, that street will still be there, our workplaces will still be our workplaces. And our starting point for socialism is the question, how could we make our workplace work for the community, and particularly work in a democratic cooperative framework beyond the framework imposed by the employer? And that's that. So we need to be, I think it's clear, we need to be realistic. And I'll give the great example. You know, there's some people claim in socialism we'll all be vegetarian, or some other people get very angry with those people and say, no, we bloody won't. The point is, you know, we don't want to say socialism, it will be like this, and for very good reasons, because it has to arise democratically. And it's not the answer to all problems. It's not the answer to animal rights, necessarily. But what socialism is, it's a means, in fact, it's a short version. It is the fact that we will have the means by which human beings rationally, collectively, democratically can debate, discuss and decide how to run the world. Where the vegetarianism argument can be had free from the idea that there's vested interests who've got lots of money to be made from selling meat, or from selling vegetarian foods, or from one side or the other. We can just say we here are going to do this work, we're going to do this together, but do we actually think about this? So what socialism does, it doesn't produce the perfect world, it doesn't produce a panacea, it produces a situation where we can at least work it out. Even that sounds tremendously hippie-ish. We can work it out, because at the present moment, as I've just indicated, the key problem with capitalism is it is run initially in the first interests of people who own it, but ultimately, even then, after a while, certainly when we get to the state we're in at the moment, it's not one for the people who want it. I mean, they're there and they're doing very nicely. They're doing very nicely while we're suffering and our wages are being reduced and our rents are going up and ours are becoming much more expensive and they're making billions and the gap between rich and poor is rising. But then the gap between rich and poor at the end of the last Labour government was pretty much as great as before the first Labour government ever came in. You know, so that's the hard and fast outcome of a century of Labourism. But ultimately, it becomes run in the interest of the property itself. The property gets in the way. And as we see at the present moment, I mean, that is what a capitalist crisis is that the property is sitting on the books and it can't be moved, no matter how much the person might want to do something with it, because it has to be turned over, it has to be changed into a commodity and back into money again. And that key fact of turning over capital to return it to the state of capital is ultimately the thing that is holding back this tremendous cooperative labour that has been summoned up by world capitalism. I mean, in our propaganda we use the short term, it's the law of no profit, no production. But I mean, ultimately it's not just no profit, it is also that you have to make your capital back. It has to, otherwise you end up with this phantom capital sitting in some zeros and ones in a ledger, standing in the way where we can use the machinery, we can use these processes to our own ends. I mean, we have no better example at the moment than the fact that once again farmers are literally pouring milk out on the land because they've produced so much that the market can't bear the weight and that the prices are falling down. And once again, we're seeing that the Tories are prepared to intervene in the economy to back up their mates. So socialism essentially overcomes this problem. It is cooperative labour unshackled by the interests of property. Cooperative labour where we will, if we throw labour into a project, not demand that we get labour back out of it. We'll say, well, we've lost some time, but our lives go on. We'll try and do it differently next time. If things go wrong, we have a way of just going, forget it, let's move on to the next project. And socialism has the capacity to throw essentially labour at the problem. I mean, we in the present moment, I'm trying to make a new form of argument on the internet, there is an abundance of labour. If you think about the current productive output of capitalism as it exists now, we have across Europe and America about 10% unemployment. We have millions involved in activities like security guards or financiers that are just geared up towards simply maintaining and enforcing the existing system. And we have also got to all sorts of activities like the civil service, unproductive, and that's come out of the imbalance in effective demand. It basically means that the people who work as servants for the very rich, when there are people living in dire poverty. But even if we take all of that unused and wasted effort, we still have enough to feed, clothe and house every man, woman, child on earth. If we took current production levels and simply shifted the production gears towards serving the vast majority. So even with capitalism, the carrying capacity is already there. It's just that we need to basically take that capacity and use it democratically, and then we have it in reserve, the reserve army of labour. We can use that to reduce our working hours or to assault new problems. And I think that, just to come back to some of the definitions of socialism, I mean, the famous one, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. Well, at the present moment, capitalism does not demand from each according to their ability, it's from each according to what the market can afford to pay for them. So we have these millions idling on the dole. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense of they're being idle. I mean that we are being impoverished by their impoverishment. And, you know, some of these people could be doing useful work, and it's useful for themselves to be working. So I'm trying to be very quick about this. Coming to an end, I mean, the point is that once we have this community of shared goods where people can use their labour and the return comes back to them and the return comes to us, we will be able to work at the problems that we have in the world, and we won't necessarily solve them overnight, but we will be able to work towards something. And that's that. I think if you look at the Millennium Development Goals, the Millennium Development Goals want to halve the numbers of people in slum housing. They want to mitigate child poverty or end child poverty. But I mean, when they talk about ending child poverty, I don't see how you can end child poverty without ending adult poverty. You know, we've got all these people who are working really tremendously hard and in material terms. You know, I mean, they have managed to get clean water to so many people who didn't have it before. Millions of people have got clean water now. So it's more out of sadness that they're not setting their sights higher and saying, well, no one should have dirty water, no one should have to live like that. And I think that this is one of my favourite phrases from the Communist Manifesto. I think it sums up everything about why we should want socialism. And, you know, socialism isn't about, you know, the socialism of the barracks. It's not that we're going to have a little cell each, and you'll be given your ration of food, and you'll have everyone have the same clothes or something. Because the world is a big place, and once we've liberated labour and we can just use it freely to just to make all sorts of different things, then of course there'll be a wonderful variety to be had. I mean, the point is, you know, we have to fight the idea that socialism will be about regimenting and subordinating labour to some sort of scientific Übermind plan. It is about the emancipation of the working class. But my favourite overall phrase is, socialism will be a society where the condition for the free development of all should be the free development of each. And I think that just sums up the present moment. Capitalism has produced this wonderful society where the development of all, obviously the all as an aggregate, has got better. But there are some who are at the bottom of the pile who are the ones who are being stood upon to reach these high limits, and their development is being stunted. And they're the ones who have ultimately will have to overthrow socialism so that they can overthrow capitalism, so that they can develop into free and fully developed human beings. So I've rattled on and talked actually for about 25 minutes, and that's all I wrote, so that's probably all I'd have said anyway, even if there'd been more people here. But what I've hopefully tried to do is I've hopefully tried to keep forward a reason why we need to have a talk about the case for socialism. And I've defined the ultimate case as being the fact that someone has to do the work. And as long as people have to do the work, then people should benefit from doing the work. That capitalism has brought together this tremendous capacity for human beings to work, but it's fettered it, and it's fettered it by its own nature in an inhuman way to the interests of property. And I've tried to suggest that socialism will be, once you've emancipated labour, will be able to throw labour at the problems, and we will be able to work to make our lives better because we will be working for our own benefit. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you, Bill. Well, we'll now throw the meeting at questions and discussion.
I do have a question, actually. How do you see, because I'm a little confused, having read the Socialist magazine, about exactly how capitalism is going to be overthrown. It talks about through the democratic process, parliamentary process, but I can't see personally how that's going to happen. Can you explain that to me, please?
Yes, well, I mean, for starters, I mean, I deliberately set out tonight, to the talk, the case for socialism, I deliberately divorced it from the how of socialism.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No. That's a perfectly valid question. I mean, we certainly do see, it's not that we are entirely wedded to Parliament or to political democracy. I mean, we see the case socialism coming about through the vast majority understanding and wanting it. It is just that in conditions in which democracy is available, it is preferable to use that and to try and avoid using, because we want socialism to be as productive as possible. And unlike William Morris, I don't see a catastrophic civil war being the most productive way of getting there. We want to take over. Like I said, we want to take over the streets and factories as they are and start using them to our own ends. But the key condition is that we have to see that, certainly for the vast majority of people, the current system can't work in their own interest. And, I mean, one of the things that's historically happened and what Labour used to do and what the Tories do is they've all relied on growth. Because as long as people have been getting a bit more than they had last year, the people would generally be able to buy into the system. Even if the more that they're getting this year is relatively less than they used to get last year. You know, but at least they can see this year they've got the plasma screen TV where last year they didn't. People buy in, and they've always said, "Well, it's not." The Social Democrats always say it's not about redividing the cake; it's making the cake bigger. It's important. But of course, the president, what they're talking about now is 10 years without growth. Well, 10 years without growth, 20 years without growth. When it gets to the point where people are going to go, "Our lives just aren't going to get any better. We're just facing grinding rents for our pays are going up."
Our lives will become progressively worse, and they have done. Many people.
I think I don't necessarily think they have to be progressively worse. I think it is that they can see that they're not going to get much better. I think that's more damaging than getting. I mean, yes, people will fight to defend what they have, and I think the main difficulty will be for capitalism and capitalists when the fight to just maintain the status quo becomes a kind of existential struggle for the system. Because when it gets to the point where if workers strike to demand higher pay and the system just simply cannot deliver it, then things start to fall apart and a space opens. But as I say, our chief hope is that people will see, well, look, there is a way that our interests can be furthered, but they just can't be furthered under this system. So, and we do see signs of this. I mean, part of what we, pardon me. I mean, some members are taken with the Zeitgeist movement, which is going on at the moment, because suddenly there's a lot of people saying we could abolish money, and they believe in using technology to do that. And then the Occupy movement came along, and there were some people with interesting ideas there. We didn't invent socialism, and we don't claim to be the sole custodians of it. We keep an eye out for where, we're a bit like the donkey in 1984, we've seen this all before. We'll see it again. We have things to say about it, which is, but the old idea: the party is the memory of the class, and all of that. So these shoots keep coming up, and the themes do re-emerge independently of us. So it's possible, after a while, when they gain enough currency, some people will start turning around and saying, "Well, okay, but we need to coordinate it." And I mean, the only two things we say about revolutionary process, we say that there does need to be something like a party, which, because that's how you maintain democracy, it's how you can coordinate, it's how you can disown idiots. It's nothing to do with us. Look, we've got formal democratic processes, we know who's our spokesperson, and also that you need to use political action, because ultimately you can't ignore the state. So I mean, that's the only sort of political action and a political party to that end. But we don't necessarily mean it'll have to be us as we are. But it would be nice.
Thank you.
I think personally, talking about getting the majority for socialism and it being brought about, I think you would require an overwhelming majority in favour of such a radical change in the way human beings organise. If it was a simple majority, you can envisage all kinds of problems with that. A simple majority might work in some situations when you're trying to reach a decision, and if you want to make a decision, a simple majority may be okay. But a decision as big as that, something that affects the way people live and the way they organise work and run society, I think you'd need a vast majority in favour of it to bring it about. And then how the mechanics of bringing it about might be a bit overtaken by events, really. When there's all that demand in society for socialism, then all kinds of avenues and channels I could envisage would be used. And it may be that Parliament would be sort of become a rather redundant way of doing it. I mean, it's kind of guesswork. But that's the way we approach it. We approach it at present by testing the water to see how much support there is for socialism by putting out candidates, and it's a fairly good yardstick of where we stand. Mm-hmm. Although people might be dissuaded to vote in favour of something simply because they know that there's no chance of it succeeding at the moment. There's not enough people in favour of it, so they would take some persuasion perhaps to vote.
Yeah, that's right. They feel it's a wasted vote, essentially, when it comes to voting. I mean, you had a few candidates standing recently.
We proved scientifically that we are the 1%. Because that was the percentage of what we got. But I was one of our branch members recently died. He wrote some books. One of them was called "It's More of Us Than You Think." And there's another one, Stop Supporting Capitalism, Start Building Socialism. And in that, he borrows models from advertising, if I recall. And there's this model in advertising. You have the blue sky thinkers, the early adopters, early majority, late majority, obstinate resistors. And they use this in change management training in new workplaces. So they'll say, OK, so you have the blue sky thinkers, the people who, you know, that would be us. The early adopters would be, you know, a small proportion of the electorate prepared to vote for us, but not necessarily joining the party. And then the case becomes how rapidly we can move from early majority to late majority. That's the tricky bit. And of course, the obstinate resistors will be obstinate resistors for a long time to come. But we're not proposing. I'm certainly not proposing to, you know, send them to education camps or anything like that. I'm just proposing to outvote them and to ultimately say, well, we'll work around you. I mean, I'd prefer to think that. I mean, this is why I put so much emphasis, I think, on, you know, that we'll be able to chuck Labour at the problem and just sort it out that way, because, you know, we're the working class. What we do is we work, we cooperate, and we produce. I'd prefer to see us use creative solutions rather than destructive ones. And I think just working our way and producing our way around, I think, is the most powerful thing that we can do when we take control. And the problem is that the weapon is destruction, and there's not a lot you can do when you're dead. So we have to, at the very least, take away the means of death. As we've seen in Syria, you know, when they choose to unleash it, I mean, they might not win, but they can make such a bloody death toll that you'd think twice about taking those buggers on. And there's even talk now that they're trying to play out for some sort of balkanisation outcome, so some of them can defend their property by creating a small Alawite state or something like that. And you know, I can imagine the powers that be might try that here. You know, they'll try and build their little capitalist enclaves. They'll stake them out with guns and weapons, and maybe we'll have to work around them for a few years. I mean, I suppose the bigger question is, ultimately, yes, we can get, you know, the big danger is we get a huge thumping majority in one country and not in any others. I mean, you know,
then you work here, you'd be a socialist in isolation, which would be
no use to anyone. Yeah,
yeah.
I think it's the difficult question of what you do when you're a substantial minority. That's the, you know, if you like the tricky bit of our case that there's not any particular answer for. All we can do is say that we have our optimal outcome, which is the vast majority vote for and want socialism. But if they come for us when we're 25% of the vote, and they choose to start the civil war or something like that, then we'll have to work it out then.
Mm.
But I don't think that's likely. Silence isn't very good on the radio. So I had some questions I was prepared to throw out in case of these end up in this round. And it's one that arose, actually, John and me were talking about this on the way up, because I gave this talk recently about the Inca society and how relevant it is to socialism. And the point of my talk was that it wasn't socialism. It was what most ancient societies go through, a sort of supply and command economy. But one of the features that I noticed as I was even just giving the talk was that by and large, the Inca villages were self-replicating and almost self-sustaining. They just had a few tools that they could take from their immediate environment, and they could just plonk up and plonk down and set up a new village wherever they needed to. And this leads me to, you might think it's a slightly bizarre question, I'll rephrase it though. Will there be iron brew cans in socialism? My original question was, would there be crisp packets in socialism? I mean, the point being that we have in capitalism, again, talking about waste, we have all these goods that they do processed food because that processing it and making it into a tin adds value. And what capitalism cares about is value. So maybe one thing we'll find in socialism is we'll lose all these little conveniences, convenience foods and packets of crisps and the like, but because what socialism will deliver will be potatoes and some cooking oil and maybe a fat fryer if you want to make some chips for yourself. But the point will be that we'll get rid of a lot of, I'm suggesting, I'd say that the consumer goods as we know them would go by the wayside, and it very much would be just providing primary goods and tools and things, and saying, well, go on, make yourself a house, make yourself some food. We don't have to plan down to the last packet of crisps for socialism. So I don't know if people would be interested in thinking that.
What would be the reason for that? Would that be because of the economics, or would it be it would revert back to more basics? Because a socialist society would not be able to produce initially the everything that people needed.
I think. Well, in the first instance, as things happen, the capitalism is producing these goods. You know, I mean, it's when you find a can of Coke is cheaper than a bottle of actual water, or you find that sweets are cheaper than fruit and veg and fairly nutritious foods. But the production is skewed towards these things. But also in terms of just simplifying production for ourselves. Whereas we have this whole complexity of cans and packaging and which admittedly it does have certain economic advantages because it keeps the food. But I thought we could the idea may be that instead because we as a community all we have to do is provide the basics and say, well, an individual, you're free to go off and make something else of it if you want, but as a community we won't necessarily build you your Ferrari. But we'll provide the means for building kit cars, or would we build?
You could accuse capitalism of wasting the world's resources by producing these goods. Mm. As you say, it's good for them because they take raw materials and then they turn them into these. I particularly have a disliking for crisps, in fact. And I don't know how vast numbers of people are conned into eating something that's wonderful like potato, and they prefer to eat it in the form of a crisp. And of course, it is incredibly bad value if you think about it. They're turning into these things. And it's just an awful way of eating a potato.
It's very high.
The price.
Very high profit.
That's right. That's why they're interested in it, because
they
have a vast profit out of it. Yeah.
It's convenient. As a snack is how most people will view it. You're quite right, it's not something that is...
But that's if you thought about it, put your mind to it, that'd be replicated hundreds and thousands of times in all these commodities.
Yeah, all these types of
goods. People are persuaded to consume, and I think...
Well, they're persuaded by advertising. They're persuaded by advertising, primarily, and also... examples from their peers and everything. And
also, you hit the key on the head when you said convenience food. I mean, when you have half your waking hours is spent at work and the best part of your energy is spent there, and you get home and you go, I just want some quick calories. So that's what I find a packet of crisps is. It's very convenient calories for not a huge sum. Yes, it's obviously a lot of added value for them. I mean, how cheap the inputs must actually be.
And they quite like that, of course, don't they? Because they're part of the advertising, part of the marketing is to say, we know you haven't got any time, They don't say, we've made you work all these hours and we've made you tired, so now you have to buy our goods, our packaged goods. But they sell it as a great advantage. Yeah, we know you've been working hard, so here's a ready meal, here's something that's... Lanto's got lots of other additives and nasties hidden in it that won't make you healthy. And it costs a lot of money.
And value for money is extremely poor value.
That's right, yeah, and that's replicated thousands of times, isn't it? Thousands.
Oh, absolutely, I agree with you.
And part of the point is it is that it becomes, once you start thinking that way, it does become progressively easier to see how we could collectively manage a socialist economy, a socialist world, when we say, well, what we're doing is we're freeing up all this labour time that's currently stored up in these things. We say, okay, well, we're just going to make sure that we've got this key set of goods, and then go, well, you know, get on with it and sort of fettle for yourselves, if you will. I mean, that's one way socialism could go. I mean, we don't know. The point is that we'll use our native wits and decide at the time. I mean, one other thing I think that possibly we'll see in socialism is a tremendous amount of argument. I don't know if none of you actually live around these parts, but the local rags, the Camden New Journal and the Islington Tribune, for ages the letters page was absolutely filled with the sighting of the 162 bus stop.
162 bus stop?
I think it was the 162, it might be the 62. I'm trying to remember now.
Where it was actually sighted?
Where they were going to put the bus stop in Hampstead.
Right.
And so what you had was these very eloquent people, and you can see this difference, that these are the people who feel that they can run the world, who feel that they have the confidence to have an opinion, and who can actually back it up with legal action and campaigning and organisation. You kind of see the difference. You know, you see a lot of times in working class areas, you know, their idea of political action is just going, bloody buggers at the council. They're in it for themselves. And that's it, you know, whereas these people were filling up and they just thought, well, we have a right to have a say in where the 162 bus stop's going to be. It's dangerous over there. We should have it at that end of the lane. That's outside my house. I don't want it there. You know, that. But in some way, that's what socialism could be. It could be filled with these lovely arguments that we can all head up about rather than why are so many people starving, you know. I'd much rather be arguing about where the 162 bus stop should go. And of course, if we've freed up all this time from having to directly work, we will have time to argue. I mean, you know, I mean, the one problem with Cameron's big society, which I suppose is in some ways almost socialist, he wants people to work for free. No one's done it because, of course, we are compelled we have to try and find a way to work for a living in the first instance. And it does kind of get in the way because, you know, anyone, I mean, I'll say it tonight, you know, it's been hard enough to organise this meeting, however badly it's been organised. You know, I'm sure if I'd had more time and more nous about how to do it, I could have organised it better, and there'd be rafts of people here. But, you know, life gets in the way of organising things like this. And
it, absolutely.
You know, we have to try and get as much as we can out of it, which is obviously one of the reasons why we can record it. So at least this discussion goes on the interweb and does reach more people than are in the room.
I think Cameron's jumping on that bandwagon of big society is, I find it very insulting. You know, I mean, I think actually lots of us are doing work that isn't paid, you know, all over the places.
I think you're right in ways.
People, you know, if they actually stopped and examined how their lives are conducted, there's lots of ways that you're not actually getting like a wage or a salary in order to make you do it. You know, you don't sort of do nothing until someone pays you a wage or a salary. There's lots of work to be done. Yeah, if you're giving a broad definition of the word work, you know, just sort of expending energy in some way, or mental or physical energy, lots of us are doing that, but yeah, it's not practical to wait for someone to pay you a wage or a salary. You know, things have to be done in your community or workplace or whatever it might be, particularly a community, not so much workplace, a community that, you know, if you're in a residential block or something and you need to organise things in that block, you can't expect to get paid for it. And then people who look after aged relatives...
Well, this is the carer.
There's carers.
The carers are probably the biggest group.
Biggest one, yeah.
I've done that myself, so I know what it's like. At the same time, working full-time and doing everything else that you do in life, it's...
Yeah, well, I know that's why we're talking in the corner there. We have an example of the big society. We have a toy library, which is noticeably it's locked. But there's another slightly pernicious side to the big society, which is that he fundamentally believes that local councils are not community organised for themselves. While we're no fans of the state, I don't think we'd see necessarily, you know, the fact that the local council organises a library as being part of some evil domineering side of the state. I mean, we know the part of the state that is our enemy, and that's the arms part of the state. But you know, the fact that they organise a local library is not part of some vast overarching sign of impending dictatorship. But for him, obviously, it was run by volunteers. And instead, what happens is they get run by volunteers and then closed down because no one has the time to actually run them.
That's right.
Working libraries, not local ones. But the biggest part of the cost of a library is the staff. Staff and buildings. And of course, you know, they're the things that suck at the time. Surely, given it's 5 minutes to, we have to be out.
Yeah.
There's no more contributions, yes, well. Wind up the meeting. Thank you very much for turning up.
Thank you.
Thank you. I found it very interesting.
Thank you for coming all this work.